Okay. I don't know if you know this song or not, but I'm going to read you the lyrics. This here's a song about two sets of Joneses, Rothschild, Evelyn, Reuben, and Sue. And just for discussion through random selection, we've chosen two couples who haven't a clue. Rothschild was lucky to marry so wealthy. Evelyn bought him a house on the beach. Reuben and Sue, they had nothing but Jesus. And at night they would pray that he would care for them each. And the rain came down, and it blew the four walls down. And the clouds, they rolled away, and one set of Joneses was standing that day. Evelyn's daddy was proud of young Rothschild. He worked the late hours to be number one. Just newlyweds, and their marriage got rocky. He's flying to Dallas, and she's having a son. Reuben was holding a Gideon's Bible, and he screamed, "It's a boy," so that everyone heard. And the guys at the factory took a collection, and again God provided for bills he incurred. And the rain came down, and it blew the four walls down. And the clouds, they rolled away, and one set of Joneses was standing that day. So what is the point of this story? What am I trying to say? Well, is your life built on the rock of Christ Jesus, or a sandy foundation you've managed to lay? Well, needless to say, Evelyn left her husband and sued him for every penny he had. But I truly wish that those two would find Jesus before things get worse than they already have. And the rain came down and it blew the four walls down. And the clouds, they rolled away, and one set of Joneses was standing that day. There's two sets of Joneses. Which one will you be? Maybe you prefer country, so let's go to Leukenbach, Texas, with Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living has got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs, and Blue Eyes crying in the rain, out in Leukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans, and go away. This coat and tie is choking me. In your high society, you cry all day. We've been so busy keeping up with the Jones, 4-car garage, and we're still building on. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. By the way, the reason nobody feels no pain in Leukenbach is because there's nobody in Leukenbach. But I want to show you, by the way, this is, go back real quick, Valentine. That's Mount Sinai. I thought it would be appropriate as we're finishing out the last of the Ten Commandments, just to give you a visual image here. At least that's what most scholars believe to be Mount Sinai. So it's still a very powerful and very formative location, especially for the Jews who still live in that area. Okay, I want to know if you've seen this bumper sticker. He who dies with the most toys wins. Somewhere along, and I've also seen it on mugs and on t-shirts and stuff like that. I think it came out sometime in the 80s. But somewhere we picked up this notion that stuff buys happiness. And to a degree, maybe there's a little bit of truth to that. But not for very long, right? Sometimes our happiness lasts only as long as whatever we have until it breaks or something like that. What lasts longer? A refrigerator or maybe a dishwasher built in 1985 or one built in 2005? Old stuff, right? Typically, especially with appliances, that's true. Stuff doesn't seem to last as long nowadays. I don't know if you've caught on to that. Or cars, for instance, automobiles. Does a car last longer that was built in 1990 or one that was built in 2009? Well, the old stuff tends to last longer. In fact, I don't know if you believe this or not, but it's true. There's a reason for that, and they do that on purpose. Because eventually they figured out, well, if we make stuff break down more often and we don't, you know, make stuff last forever, then eventually they're going to have to come back and buy more. And that's what they want, because that's what our economy is built off of. The last of the Ten Commandments. We've got the last of these very foundational, spiritual and yet incredibly practical principles that God blessed His people with on Mount Sinai. Of which He starts out saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of slavery. I'm the Lord your God who is with you when times are hard. I am the Lord your God. I'm the Lord your God when you are in the slavery of your sin, when you are in bondage to your evil desires. I'm the Lord your God who still, when you didn't know what you were going to do and you were stuck in the desert and you didn't know what direction you were going to go, I was still and I am still the God of all creation. You shall have no other gods before me. Do not covet. Don't set your heart on anything but me. Verse 17, Exodus 20, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or his maidservant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. The word covet, the actual Hebrew word, means an enthusiastic desire. Or the translation that I like a little bit better is an insatiable desire. You know what insatiable means, right? So we've got the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, and the tenth commandment, do not covet. They actually work as bookends of the commandments. Because what happens when you covet? Those things become an idol. Those things have the potential of becoming gods, right? So Ephesians 5, verse 5. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetous, that is, an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. I was listening to a sermon that Forey Grove gave. He's the preacher out in A&M Church Christ. He said this, Commandment 1 and Commandment 10 are about the fact that I do not get to decide what is mine. In order to get to heaven, we have to lose ourselves. Somewhere along the way, we have to figure out that life is not about my wants and my desires. As Americans, we have certain rights. But as Christians, we give up a lot of our rights. Our rights to have and to have and to get whatever it is our sinful heart craves. My wants must be secondary to God's will. And let me clarify something for you. When it says in verse 17, don't covet your neighbor's stuff. You've got to remember, we're talking thousands of years ago. They didn't have the curse of advertising and marketing through TV or the radio or, you know, driving down their chariot and seeing billboards all over the roads, right? They didn't have the curse of marketers and advertisers constantly invading our lives and trying to get us to buy into their empty promises that if you will buy this, if you'll get this, then you'll find happiness. They didn't have that quite to the degree that we do today. And so it's not just today our neighbor's stuff. All they saw was their neighbor's stuff. Now we see stuff that people have in Hollywood and in, you know, our whole American society. We get to see all these different facets of it, not just what our neighbor has, right? So, do not covet. As Christians today, we're like salmon trying to swim upstream through our American society, which requires a lot of strength. It requires a lot of boldness and courage to go against the grain, to swim upstream, to swim up the waterfalls when everyone else is saying, just go with the flow. You know, you don't need God. You don't need all that other stuff. All you need is you need this car, you need this pair of shoes or whatever it is. And that is what you need for your life. And we are challenged to go against the grain and to stand out against that kind of behavior and not to covet. Sand Van Eemen has this quote that I came across. It said, "Advertising has a very influential yet deceptive voice. Because media come in so many forms, the voice is everywhere, suggesting lifestyles, promising belonging, and disorienting its listeners. Somehow in the middle of this din, we are supposed to discern how to be faithful Christians." Our society runs on coveting. That's what capitalism, you know, is all about. If we can get people to buy more and buy more stuff, then that will make our industries bigger, and you know that will give people more jobs and stuff like that. That's what our society runs off of, is getting its citizens to covet, right? If we were a nation of completely content people with what we had, we wouldn't have these huge, giant industries that make billions of dollars off of people's wants and desires. And it's a spiritual issue, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever heard this notion, I'm sure you have, but that every person has this God-shaped hole in our heart. You ever heard that before? Okay. Well, if you haven't, the notion is that every person, every human being has this hole in ourselves. And constantly we try to fill it with certain things, but, you know, eventually we're going to have to figure out that the only thing that will satisfy us is God. So it's this God-shaped hole that we have inside ourselves, and nothing else exactly will fit there. It might for a time, but eventually it will lose its luster. It won't work anymore. God is the only thing that is satiable, that satisfies. Walt Mueller, who, if you've been in youth ministry for any amount of time, then you know the name Walt Mueller. He did a pretty extensive essay on marketing and advertising. I want to read you some of his thoughts on that. He said, "Marketing plays into and exploits that emptiness and yearning by promising redemption, fulfillment, wholeness, and satisfaction through the purchase and use of products. In effect, marketing substitutes a false gospel for the true gospel. If we believe marketing's promise to deliver promises, in fact, that it never can deliver, we run the risk of falling into the endless cycle of believing the lies and buying product after product in the hope that somehow this time will be fulfilled." I want to show you a picture. This was a gumball machine, you know, maybe 20 years ago. Go ahead and hit that slide down. Hit the button. The right arrow button. Okay, we'll wait for him to figure that out. A gumball machine 20 years ago was a glass globe, right? And you got all these colors of gumballs in there. And you put in the quarter, and you turn the crank, and out comes a little gumball. Now, a gumball machine is like this big, and you've got all these tracks and carousels and loop-de-loops and tunnels and funnels and all this kind of stuff where you put in the quarter and it takes 30 seconds for you to get your gumball because it's about the experience of watching the gumball go through this track. Okay, that's 20 years ago. Click it again. There you go. There's a gumball machine today. To where it's not really about getting the gumball. It's about the experience of the gumball, of getting it, of purchasing it. And that's the way they get you to buy it, is if I can give them this experience, this exciting little moment of joy, then they'll buy whatever cheap thing it is we have to give them. It's no longer about the product, it's about the experience. If you watch some commercials, you'll notice that car companies don't really sell cars anymore. They sell experiences, right? They sell the thrill of driving that particular car. You know, you slam on the gas pedal and you hear the engine roar and you got the wind blowing in your face and you got these girls in this other car over here checking you out because you're so good looking or something because you drive this particular car. You know, they don't sell the car, they're selling the experience. Watch a few commercials and see if I'm wrong, okay? And then they make you pay out the wazoo for that experience, for that thrill of having it. Marketers spend in the United States, this, I'm not talking about just what it costs to make the product and how much the product's value is. I'm talking about simply the amount of money that marketers spend on getting the word out to you that you should buy something. Marketers in the United States spend $278 billion a year to get you to buy something. In effect, that's over $2,000 for your house. Personally, for your household, the marketers in the United States are paying $2,000 a year for you to buy stuff. Research shows that marketing is so effective and advertisers are so good at doing what they do now that they can have kids recognize logos by 18 months old. And by the time, actually before they reach their second birthday, they can ask for products by brand name. I don't know if that's happened to you. It hadn't happened to me yet because she can't really even say all these words. But I do know that she can recognize logos. At least she can recognize a power button. But that's what marketers, that's what advertisers do. They start from birth. And every single television show and every single iPad app has applications on it. And, you know, from birth to the day you die, you're seeing advertisement after advertisement, whether you believe it or not, whether you think it or not, whether you live in a, you know, isolated bubble and you don't see any person or any commercial, you're still being fed advertisements every day of your life. There was a marketing executive on a talk show, and the host started to get curious with her and said, "So how do you start marketing a campaign to sell hamburgers?" Because she was a marketing executive that led campaigns for this fast food hamburger company. Okay, she said, "We've taken a page out of Satan's book. Find a weakness and lust in every man, woman, and child, and target that weakness to make them want to buy a product." That's how our society runs, to exploit that God-shaped hole in your being, to exploit that emptiness, and to promise you something else in exchange for that. If you'll buy this, then you will be satisfied. If you buy this or you give into this particular experience, then you will now be complete and that will give you happiness and joy or satisfaction, whatever it is they promise, if you'll only buy that product. I came across a number the other day that talked about how many advertisements we see each day. I was asking Karen, how many advertisements do you think we see each day? I was curious what her thought was. You know, she started at 100, and I said, no, it's higher. She said, 500, no, it's higher than that. The number of advertisements, at least in 2007, so it's higher now. In 2007, the number of advertisements that each person saw a day was 5,000. And that was before Facebook started putting advertisements on your Facebook page. If you sign into your Facebook page, you see something like this, and you see all your, this is Karen's. You see all your stuff in the middle, and then you see 50% off cute kids' shoes, and click like for tips, tricks, and deals from Canon Camera, and you know, Johnson's photo contest, and figure out how Rachel Ray lost 32 pounds. I don't care, but they spend a lot of money to put that there. Whoever's selling whatever it is that they're gonna sell. Because when you click on, oh, I want to lose 32 pounds just like Rachel Ray did, you know, you click on that and then, you know, it'll take you to some site and says, you know, well, she did this particular diet and exercise and then she used these pills and you got to buy these pills in order to lose the 32 pounds, right? And that's what happiness is losing weight and looking beautiful and all that. And constantly, even if you're not looking at TV all day long or any day long, you're constantly being fed these advertisements. No longer do you have to go out onto, the highway to see billboards. You don't even have to go outside your home. You don't even have to turn on the TV. Advertisements come straight to you through your Facebook page or whatever else it is, internet pop-ups and stuff like that. Here's a simple principle for you. The farther away you are from God, the more empty you feel. The emptier you feel, the more prone you are to buy into the marketing products and promises. And the more you buy those products and give into those promises, eventually the more empty you feel. And it starts the cycle of dissatisfaction over and over and over again. Jesus puts it this way when he spoke to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4. Said, whoever returns to these wells will always come back thirsty. In other words, whoever goes to these wells, whatever promises the world has to offer, will always have an insatiable desire. But whoever drinks the water I give will never thirst. My dad sent me an email a couple days ago, and he's one of those guys where he sends out more emails than he should have time in a day to read. But nevertheless, I read 10% of them, and usually they're pretty good. I came across a little piece in one that had a quote, a little story that Max Lucado wrote in there. I want to read this story to you. When my daughter was a toddler, I used to take her to the park not far from our apartment. One day, as she was playing in a sandbox, an ice cream salesman approached us. I purchased her a treat, and when I turned to give it to her, I saw her mouth was full of sand. Where I had intended to put a delicacy, she had put dirt. Did I love her with dirt in her mouth? Absolutely. Was she any less of my daughter with dirt in her mouth? Of course not. Was I going to allow her to keep the dirt in her mouth? No way. I loved her right where she was, but I refused to leave her there. I carried her over to the water fountain and washed out her mouth. Why? Because I loved her. God does the same for us. He holds us over the fountain. Spit out the dirt, honey, our Father urges. I've got something better for you. And so He cleanses us of filth, immorality, dishonesty, prejudice, bitterness, and greed. We don't enjoy the cleansing. Sometimes we even opt for the dirt over the ice cream. I can eat dirt if I want to, we pout and proclaim, which is true, we can. But if we do, the loss is ours. God has a better offer. If I had gotten to write the 10th commandment, I would have wrote it kind of like this. Don't desire all the stuff that this world has to offer. Am I not better than what this world can offer you? What are we saying when we covet? What we're saying is, God, I don't believe that you're good enough. If I could maybe have you and this thing over here, then maybe that would be enough, and then I would really be happy. Imagine this scene. A bride and a groom standing at the altar on their wedding day. And the groom says, I love you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. I will die for you if need be. And she says, yeah, I love you too. But I just want you to know before we get too far with this that in order for me to really feel whole and complete, we need to always have a 4-bedroom house. And I need to have diamonds each year, or at least every other year. And I need to drive this particular luxury vehicle and this, that, and the other. And so often that's what we do with God. We say, God, I love you and all. I know that satisfaction is found in you, maybe. But really, I need you and this, right? That's usually what our lives play out. The tenth commandment is a heart issue. Not coveting is a way of telling God, I don't need the popularity. I don't need the money. I don't need those material possessions because you complete me. And I don't need anything or anyone else to complete me except for you. That's what not coveting tells God. Commandment 1 says, life is all about God. Have no other gods before me. And Commandment 10 says, life is not about you. Don't let goods become gods. Paul gives us one of the keys to overcoming covetousness. The first one, he tells the church in Philippi, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. And then later he tells Timothy, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. He tells Timothy, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. Paul says the key is learning to be content. Bill Hybel said this, contentment is not based on what we have, but who has us. Who has you? That's the key to being content. So, he who dies with the most toys still dies. You can't take any of your stuff with you. There's no winning as far as it comes to material possessions. I've never even heard of anybody who was dying on their deathbed and want to have a final glimpse at their bank statement. Or, you know, say, let me sit in my BMW one more time before I die. I've never even heard of anything like that. The one thing that people care about when they die is people. Does your life reflect that that's what you care about? And the next key to overcoming covetousness is something that Jesus talks about. You remember the story of the rich young ruler, right? He comes up to Jesus and he says, what must I do to have eternal life? And he says, basically, obey the commandments. Don't murder, don't lie, don't steal, don't commit adultery. And he says, I've done all those things. What else do I have to do in order to inherit eternal life? And what he says is, go sell all of your possessions and give it to the poor. And he goes away sad because he knew that he couldn't do that. It's interesting if you notice that one of the commandments that Jesus doesn't mention when he tells him, he says, don't murder, don't lie, don't steal, don't commit adultery. He did not say, don't covet. Until he says, go sell all your possessions and give to the poor. Because coveting was what the rich young ruler struggled with. He had an enthusiastic, insatiable desire for his wealth. And right after that, Jesus says, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I think that's something that we take way too lightly nowadays. Luke and Matthew both said, Luke and Matthew both quote Jesus saying, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Jesus prescribes in the story of the rich young ruler the other key to overcoming covetousness, and that's giving. If somehow we can learn to give what belongs to us, at least what we think what the stuff that belongs to us, because we acknowledge that everything that we have comes from God. If we believe that and we can give those things away, it becomes a little bit easier to overcome that covetous heart that says, I have to have and I have to get more and more and more. If your life is more about giving. Proverbs 21, 25 and 26 says, the sluggard's craving will be the death of him, because his hands refuse to work. All day long he craves for more, but the righteous give without sparing. The rich man apparently didn't understand, or he forgot that when God sees us face to face, he's not going to ask, what size house did you have on earth? What kind of car did you drive? What did your retirement account look like when you died? He's not going to ask any of those things. In fact, if you read Matthew 26, it seems like the only thing that he might ask is, what did you do for the poor? What did you do for the dying and the lonely and the starving? What did you do for the least of these? Or did you store up stuff in your barns? Did you spend your life getting things that will pass away? Or did you store treasures in heaven? What did you do in your life for the least of these? What did you give? Perhaps this morning I can simply be a vessel of God for you to say, spit the dirt out of your mouth. Don't go to the empty wells that this world has to offer. What God has is so much better and so much more than what this world can possibly give. You shall have no other God before Him. Don't covet. If there's anything that we can help you with, if we can pray for you in this struggle that I think, if we're honest, many of us struggle with simply because we live in the time and day that we do. This is something that takes a lot of discipline. If there's anything that we can do in order to help you along this path, to become closer with God, maybe it's being baptized in the waters of His grace. If we can do anything for you this morning, please come and stand. Please come while we stand and sing.
Let the weak say, I am strong. Let the poor say, I am rich. Let the blind say, I can see. It's what the Lord has done in me. The weak say, I am strong. Let the poor